All right, here we are again. Hi, people. This equipment on. Okay. So we're gonna listen for a few ideas. I'm gonna listen too, even though I'm the one who's talking. I'm listening. I promise. Buddha's ideas about the mind, how to work with it. His answers, the Buddhist answers to why we are, what is this, what is that. It's just, you know, it's our food for thought. And if it's something useful, we take it on board. And, you know, we use it as tools in our daily lives. That's the point. Why? To help us become better people, less neurotic, less miserable, less fearful, more kind, more compassionate, more wise. Bottom line, that's it. Thinking this way. Sangye charang thokye thok namla janchu baru dagni kyab suchi dagi chanyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok sangye charang thokye thok namla janchu baru dagni kyab suchi dagi chanyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok Sangye charang thokye thok namla janchu baru dagni kyab suchi dagi chanyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok. So, really, if we were, you know, for the last couple of days, we've been talking about the mind. And it's just really continuing that, you know. When you weren't here the last couple of days, that's okay. Let's look at this business of how the mind works, this thing called depression, you know. It's very interesting. The simple explanation of what it is, but because it's simple an explanation doesn't mean it's easy to, you know, fix it. It's very interesting, and it takes time. I've seen this myself. It takes time to see this, as we've been talking all the time about the mind. So much of the way our mind is right now, it's instinctive. We just wake up, we know who we are. Since we're born, we follow our instincts. We seem to eat immediately and do this and do that. We are deeply instinctive in our worries. You know, little children cry, get upset, get jealous, get offended. No one had to, mummy didn't have time to teach them. We seem to be programmed with all this stuff, you know. It's so deeply ingrained. And this is actually Buddha's complete point. This is what he means by being in samsara. This stuff that, you know, in the materialist world, we think it comes from mummy, daddy genes, and we track it back to previous generations. But as we know, the Buddha's teaching, very simple, we track it back in our own mind itself. So, even whether you track it back to your mummy or to yourself, almost is a secondary point here. The whole thing to get at is to see how we come into this life, and we can see now, as whether we're 20 or 50 or 90, we can recognize similar qualities now that we had back when we were tiny. You know, I remember since a tiny child, anger easily, people said I was generous, you know, got a bit jealous. You see these qualities deep in us, deep inside us, very spontaneous, very automatic. So the one underneath all of these, the anger, the jealousy, the fears, the anxiety, the depression, the one underpinning it, as we've been discussing, as we discuss all the time, is this thing the Buddha calls attachment. Its main energetic level that we come into this life with, like we've been talking, is this deep sense, a deep feeling of dissatisfaction. This is like the disease of attachment. It seems so odd to think that dissatisfaction is a function of attachment. But look what happens when you're dissatisfied. That dissatisfied means you feel empty. You feel you have, so it's either your belly is empty, or you feel lonely, or you feel you're missing something, or you think you're not good enough. There's always something missing. It's like a space in there that's missing. That's what dissatisfaction is. And so, of course, the way we express it is, I'm usually not good enough, and it turns inward against ourself. I mean, this is really what self-hate is, actually. I'm never enough. No matter what I do, it's not enough. This is, in a way, the deepest disease we all have. We come born with this one. And then on the basis of that, of course, spontaneously, when you feel you haven't got enough, you're not enough, you're dissatisfied. And as a child, you can see some children are really much more agitated than others. That strong dissatisfaction. They get upset more easily, you know. Some people are just more placid, more content. We can see this. This is the degree of our satisfaction or dissatisfaction. And this is very instinctive in us. So on the basis of this dissatisfaction, we then naturally feel and assume there must be something there, out there, the first level is through the senses, that if I get it, it'll stop the dissatisfaction. So you feel, you know, like we are with food. Most of us, you know, we feel like there's something missing, and there's usually, well, you know, oh, well, then you go to the fridge and you look at this and you think, I'll have that. And immediately it's because you think it'll make you feel better. It'll make you feel satisfied, whatever word you like. This is very deep inside all of us. It's just how we are. Buddha says this is samsara. Now, this is what attachment is. It's this constant, like at the level of assumption, that I just must get what I want every second. And we're always feeling this. I must want this. Now I want this. Now I'll go here. Now I'll go there. Then I want that. And I'll move this way. And I'll move that way. And I'll hear this. And I'll think that. All the time the mind is pushed by this constant need to think and do and say and smell and taste something. Because that's what attachment does at this deeper level. It's energetic. It moves us forward, moves us forward, moves us forward. Now, the point is, the millisecond this attachment, this energy moving us forward, is thwarted, is blocked, doesn't get what it wants, that's the arising right there of the state of mind, the exact opposite of attachment, and it's called aversion. If it in a volatile person like me, as a sense of child, it's expressed as anger. Anger is the response when attachment doesn't get what it wants. And it's every second, though. You just get irritated. We get upset. We get annoyed. These polite words for anger, basically. You even drop something, you get upset. You know? It happens so easily. And this is like 1,000 times a day. So, aversion is this stress. The minute attachment doesn't get what it wants, like, you know, if I'm really thinking my coffee's there and I open it up and I see tea. It's not. It's hot water and I'm happy. It's what I want. You know, right there you're expecting coffee, or even you drink it and you're expecting it to taste the way you like it, but it's cold, or there's no sugar in it. Even we go, oh, yuck, don't we? That's aversion right there. Because why? The mind was wanting something else, kind of stuck on something else. Now, the point about this sounds pretty simple, but when it's working at a very subtle level, which is what it's doing, we don't notice many of the times that we're feeling stressed or anxious or depressed. Because aversion, when it goes in, for the less volatile people, yours is called depression. It's a build-up of these moments of aversion. And another way to even put it is when attachment doesn't get what it wants, which is 1,000 times a day, and it's ever so subtle, it builds up and it becomes... You know what stress is, actually? Stress is the meeting between the yearning to get something and the not getting it. That's what the build-up of stress is. That's what anxiety is. And it builds up to the subtlest level for us that we just have these panic attacks. We don't even know why we're anxious and stressed, because we don't notice our minds at this level. That's why it's an easy explanation. There's attachment and aversion happening a million times a day, you know? And it's because we're not noticing it until it's very strong. And then it's too late. It's built up already. It's like the pressure has built up. And then it explodes out, or it goes in to the point where you're inert and you just can't get out of bed one day. This is the world, you know? Look at us. And it's so instinctive. This is the problem. Therefore, that's why it's not easy to counteract it, because it happens so subtly. So we have this, we're born into this world with this deep sense of dissatisfaction. Buddha would say it's because of practicing attachment in a past life. Because, you know, the suffering of attachment, as my mother used to say, it's such a profound statement, the Buddha would really like it. She used to say, Bobsy, that's what they call me, the more you get, the more you want. This is a profound statement of attachment. We believe when I get it, I'll get happy. But Buddha's actually saying, no, the more you get it, the more you'll want it, which is the suffering, the real suffering of attachment. The real suffering of attachment. But it's so instinctive in us, is what I'm getting at. It's so instinctive in us. This assumption, this dissatisfaction means, therefore, there's something missing. And that's why we turn it against ourselves. Always trying to fill up that gaping hole, fill up that space, get something. I'm sure, well, if I do this, or if I get that job, if I get that boyfriend, if I get that handbag, if I lose that amount of weight, if I change my nose this way, if I get that way, if I go to the sun, if I go to the thing, if I go to the holiday, if I go to get a job. I mean, we never stop, isn't it? Looking for something that we think when we get it, we'll get satisfied. In the beginning, it's all delicious and exciting, like my new boyfriend. Everything's like that. Oh, now I found it. But then what happens again? It starts to get boring, starts to get ugly, then you're dissatisfied again. Then we change again. This is the nightmare of attachment. And this is happening not just job by job and boyfriend by boyfriend, but second by second. And the more we go deep inside, which just takes time, the more we're going to see this process. And it's just very hard because it's so subtle, so deep ingrained, so deep down. So that's why we've got to have long-term patience with it. So depression is internal. It's when it's internalized, you know. It doesn't go out. In my life, I didn't get depressed because I got angry instead. It's quite true. People who have the tendency to not lash out, lash in. But because it's an internal process, it's not volatile, you know. It's more quiet. And it feels like hopeless and feels like despair and like kind of, oh, and dark and like there's nothing, it's useless. And when that gets very deep, this is when it becomes nihilistic and then we go kill ourselves, you know. Why do you think? This number I quoted blows my mind. In 2010, when there's the numbers of unnatural deaths in the world. 680,000 people died from terrorism, murder, war, violence, you name it. 880,000 killed themselves. That blows my mind. And why do you think? It ain't because you're happy that you kill yourself. It's not because you're angry with other people you kill yourself. It's just depression and despair. Which means there's no purpose to life, which means I'm nothing, I'm nobody, or the suffering is unbearable, or the pain is unbearable, I can't stand it, there's no point. That's the depression mode, you know? Everything's worthless. That's the depression mode. It's so interesting, and it sounds a bit intellectual, but it's very interesting if you look at when we understand Buddhist psychology more deeply and we study it more deeply. Buddhist talks about how we go these two extreme ways we go between. They talk about the two truths. They talk about the middle way, all this business. But the two extreme viewpoints, as they call it, we'll recognize these emotionally very clearly. There's the extreme of either believing that everything is hunky-dory and divine and gorgeous and finally I found happiness and wow, I'm fantastic, everything's blissful, kind of all the up-excited mode, wow, amazing, which is the expression of attachment getting what it wants when you think everything's perfect. When you find that new handbag or the new boyfriend or the new job or the whatever, the new, when it's all fresh and lovely, then the mind is all happy and excited and perky. Right? That's one extreme. And it's a wrong view, Buddha says, because it's too grasping at something. We cling to something too strongly. Now I've found it. Now I've got happiness. Now I've got the right boyfriend. Now I've got the right job. Now I've found happiness. We cling to it and make it very permanent and solid. This is sort of the up mode. You recognize what I'm saying? Then when things go wrong, you go crashing down to the other mode, which is the nihilistic one. They call it nihilism, which is everything's, you know, when the beautiful boyfriend leaves you, when you get sacked, when something bad happens, then the mind goes down. This is depression mode. This is what it is. Emotionally, that's what it is. It's a view of depression, which is that everything's hopeless and nothing and despair and what's the point? Then we go up again, look for something new, get all excited again. Then we go crashing down again. This is like we're bipolar. We're all bipolar, you know. I'm not kidding. It's just a question of degree, that's all. Honestly, the way Buddhism talks are these two extremes. They mean intellectually the views of reality, which is what's behind all this junk. We express it emotionally. Everything's up and perfect, that's the up mode. And the more extreme that is, the more hyper and mad a person is. The more, you know, like hyper. Wow, amazing, fantastic, perfect. Then you're crashing down to despair. We are all like this. This is what Buddha would call being in samsara. Another way of putting it, when attachment gets what it wants, we're all excited. When it doesn't, we're not excited, we're miserable. But it all works so subtly, we don't notice it until it's too late. Because when we notice it, we can catch it and change it. That's why it's so hard, you know. So when we get our mind to become more steady, when we control ourselves more, disciplined, do a bit of practice every day, you know, do a bit of purification, do these practices, we're seeing and hearing our mind more clearly, more sharply, more precisely. We're listening, not just seeing our feelings. That's too gross. It's actually hearing the stories in our head. And that's our trouble now. We only notice the feeling of despair and depression when it's the feeling, which is just the gross aspect of it. If we catch the thoughts underneath it, which are quite subtle, which we do eventually, must eventually, then we can begin to hear the elaborate story that depression is. You can put words to the feeling, I'm nothing, everything is worthless, it is no good, what's the point? You know, and that for sure is self-hate. Depression is self-hate. It's very simple. It's logically self-hate. Anger is other hate. Depression is self-hate, you know. In other words, it's called aversion, which is the response when attachment doesn't get what it wants. There's this intimate relationship between this attachment and aversion, and it's a million times a day. So subtle. So there's a million times a day, we're all excited and perky and wanting something, and then it doesn't get it. Then we go down, you know. Even just driving down the road, we don't think we're driving with attachment. We just think we're driving down the road feeling all nice. But look what happens when a car jumps in front of you. You get angry. We go, oh, well, that's natural. No, Buddha says that's not natural. It's a sign that you were driving with the expectation that you're going to drive without anybody disturbing you. You don't think it's like that. If you didn't have that attachment, that expectation at this subtle level, you wouldn't mind if a car hops in front. Yeah, please, sir, go in, we would say, because you didn't have attachment. This is how subtle attachment is. You don't think you've got attachment to your drink, and you drink and you go, yuck. That's because you expected it to be what it turns out not to be. That's attachment not getting what it wants. So you go, ooh, yeah, and you turn it away. Right there, that minor little kind of annoyed thing. That's attachment and aversion right there. And because this is so subtle and working all the time, this attachment is always wanting something, always thinking it should get something, and it's dissatisfied. And then the feeling of never getting it is when it becomes really strong. It's when it goes down to despair, you know. It builds up. So we've got to catch our minds every moment, and this is what is so difficult. So, but the other thing is, because it's so difficult, and it will take time, then the key to success with this process of working on our minds is, meanwhile, because it won't change overnight, we have to learn to live with it. We learn to accept this is the way it is. So it's a really important point, this, and we can easily misunderstand it. So the analogy is a bit like this. If you, let's say, you decide you're going to go to the gym to get healthy and lose a bit of weight and get a bit of muscle tone. So we know, even if we know that even if it's only a little bit of change has to happen, it'll take a few weeks. We do know that. So hear the point I'm making. Hear the analogy. You've got your goal. You see yourself with a nice muscle tone, you know, the nice, like this, thinner. You've got the vision. You're heading towards it. Nothing wrong. We're just using an analogy. So you've got to start somewhere. So you go back, you go to the gym, you come home, you look in the mirror. Effectively, nothing's changed, is it? So then, you know you've got no choice. You know you're doing the right thing. You're sowing the right seeds. You're doing the right actions. You know you're heading towards it. So you know with confidence, if you do that every day, slowly the change will come. So the change is slow. But, in other words, you haven't looked much different, so you've got to learn, even though you look in the mirror and you've got the same kind of, oh, look what I am, I'm just the same old miserable me with no muscle tone, but there's something in your mind that's happy because you know you're going towards getting muscle tone. In other words, you've got to live with the non-muscle tone until it gradually starts to change. You've got to be content with your progress, even though you can't see it yet. And it's the same with our mind. Attachment and anger and all these neuroses, to really go, it's going to take many years of hard practice. This is just how it is. So we have to learn to live with this slow process, not frantically expecting brand magical new change overnight. You've got to learn to know that it's going to take time to even see the results. So already, though, you're glad because you know you're starting to work on it. You're doing a bit of practice every day. So we've got to learn to live with all this crazy part of ourselves, but And the more we do the right tool, use the right tools, or do the practice, sow the seeds every day, like go to the gym every day, you know the results will come at some point. And that gives you confidence. That gives you courage. That gives you inspiration. And that makes it easier to deal with the stuff when it's still there every day, because you know you're working on it tiny bit by tiny bit by tiny bit. Does this make sense? We have to be courageous, in other words, to live with it, to live with these crazy roommates. I like to put it this way, these crazy roommates. You know, your anger roommate, your jealousy, your depression. They're old friends. They've been there for a long time. But we, you know, so in the first stage is you don't think you've got a problem. The whole world's got a problem, you know. Then you start to think, like Lama Zopa says, most people in the world don't even know their mind plays a role. So you start to go, well, that's interesting, my mind plays a role. Wow. That's a brand new idea. So then you start noticing what's going on in here. And one of the signs, I tell you, of success is you think you're getting worse. Just like you're the first day coming back from the gym, you've discovered muscles you didn't know you had. Is this not true? Now, if you were sitting watching television and you felt that pain, you should worry about it. You get my point? But because you go to the gym, you know, oh, I'm exhausted, but it's a good sign. Well, that's the same with looking at your mind. Once you start working on your mind, ego is going to fight back mightily, I tell you. And then we start to notice our mind more. You're going to see states of mind. You're going to see the stuff inside you as you've never seen it before. So it is scary. It is kind of horrifying. You think you're worse than you really are. But we've got to have a lot of courage to know that it's not worse. It's been there all the time. We just never paid attention to it. We always thought it was everybody else's fault, or it was always thought it was the chemicals or something, and it's not my fault. But it's our mind. It's our mind. It's our thoughts, way deep down, instinctive, deep down, held, habitual, emotional thoughts. So slowly beginning to look in and observing. In the beginning, it feels like nothing's changing, even getting worse. But the fact that we're doing the job of dealing with it, taking responsibility, knowing it's my mind, knowing I'm not set in stone, knowing this does not define who I really am, knowing, yes, depression is there, yes, anger is there, yes, jealousy is there, yes, despair is there, but it's not at the core of my being. This I can't stress enough. Just like you know that you're not fixed with having, you know, no muscle tone. It will change. Things will change, and that should give us optimism. That should give us courage. That should give us inspiration and confidence to keep doing it every day. And then, like I was saying yesterday, I think, when you do notice a problem, you're actually glad that you saw it. Like my sister, when she went to the hospital, went to the doctor for a checkup, and she found this, you know, melanoma. What's the word for when it's bad? What's it called? Malignant, thank you. Malignant melanoma. She was shocked, but she was really happy she found it, because now she can fix it. That's the attitude of a practitioner. You want to see your garbage mind. You want to see the depression, the jealousy. You want to go underneath. You want to be your own therapist, because you know that's the solution, rather than blaming and hopelessness and guilt, because that's taking no responsibility. Guilt is useless, just like blame is useless. So it's a courageous attitude to take. And we know we are the boss. We know we can change. We know we're doing it. And every day we're sowing the seeds. We don't see the results yet, but we know they will come. So that gives us confidence. And then you get a sense of you're not so concrete about it. Because the suffering of depression or of any of those delusions is that they're like absolutely rock solid, like you're set in stone. And that's what's so despairing. And that's why 880,000 people in 2010 killed themselves. More than the 680,000 killed in every other way. This blows my mind, that number. So you think about it. The people with great devotion in God, like the Muslims and the Jews and the Christians, the ones who are devoted, who are really sincere practitioners, not pretend ones, they won't kill themselves. The ones who've got real confidence in karma, Buddhists, they won't kill themselves. It's the materialists who think life is worthless that will kill themselves. It's terrible. It's just unbearable. So we have to be brave. We have to, you know, this is why, like I said last night, that I found so powerful when I first studied the Buddhist teachings, to really get some sense of the logic of how change, all it is change is possible, that we're not set in stone. This is what they're saying about in neuroplasticity. It was the greatest finding of the 20th century, that your brain, you're not stuck with what you're born with. That's another way of saying what Buddha's been saying for 2,500 years, is your mind can change, baby. That should already give us confidence. So we've got to see the status quo. Anger, depression, hopelessness, no good, blah, blah. We've got to see it. And if we think this is who I am, that's why you kill yourself. But if you think it is what's there, but I'm not stuck with it, I can change. That's what gives us confidence. That is the thought we have to have every single day. And that makes it all bearable. It's only when we think it's nothing to do about it, that's what makes it unbearable. It's hard. It's hard work because the feeling is so strong, and we follow feelings so strong. We're junkies for feelings, you know. We're not talking feelings here. We're talking more subtle, more precise, the thought processes underneath the feelings, which we have to get in touch with. This is what gives us courage. This is the main point for me that I feel so necessary that we even look at, you know. Because the feeling of ego, ironically, the feeling of ego is that I can't change, is that this is who I am. This is the status quo. When the bubble bursts and the attachment goes crashing down to despair, we can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. That's why we think there's nothing worthwhile. But when we know, it's a great phrase, light at the end of the tunnel. It's a wonderful phrase. When you're feeling despairing, you know, living with that suffering, the husband's left you for a younger version, you know, you got cancer, or whatever. When it's so panic-stricken, you can't stand the thought of it. It's okay. Things change. It's so cute and simple. Impermanence is so cute and simple. It sounds so easy. But to apply it in daily life, it gives such confidence. It causes you to pick yourself up and just keep moving. It gives you confidence, you know. It's incredibly important. And that's the fundamental point that Buddha says about our mind. That it's not set in stone. The depression is not who we really are. The anger is not who we really are. The jealousy is not who we really are. It's there. It's raging. Feels like it's running the show. It ain't. It can change. And the more we can work with our own mind and be brave and contain it and work with it and think of it and hear it and argue with it, bring out the good roommates to argue with the crazy ones, and then we will see, and then we'll just keep moving. Just keep moving. Just keep moving. Just keep moving. Never giving up. Putting one foot in front of the other, you know, knowing it's not set in stone. This itself is so optimistic. It's so encouraging. So depression is internalized anger, basically. Sounds a bit odd to us. It's what I said. See, the moment attachment gets what it wants, whether it's the night person smiling at you, whether it's a sunny day, whether you wake up in the morning and you just feel fine, your body feels comfy, you know, maybe just, you know, someone rang you up and everything's, you know, you're happy and perky, just for a moment even. That's attachment getting what it wants. How fortunate that we can get anything we want occasionally. But we don't realize it, but that attachment's frantically there all the time. It's like a hungry little vampire desperate to get those nice experiences. And if we have a whole bucket load of those nice experiences, that's what we call happiness. And it's just there all the time, driving us underneath. It's at the level of assumption that I must get the nice things. And we're hungry for the nice things, the nice sound, the nice smell, the nice taste, the nice feeling, the pleasant person, the car, the traffic not too busy, the green light, the tasty food, the coffee, the right temperature, a million things a day, a million things a day. And we don't think this is a mental illness. Buddha would call all this a mental illness, the assumption that I must get what I want. That's what attachment functions at this deeper level. And the second it doesn't, it can be really mild, like the irritation when it's not the right temperature. That's the proof that attachment was there. When the person's mean to you, and you suddenly feel hurt, you know. When the weather's really cold and you haven't got your coat on, we resist, you know. And this is what's happening all the time. We just think it's automatic. It's not automatic. It's the mind never stopping. Attachment never stopping, being a junkie to wanting what it wants every second. The second it doesn't, that turns into aversion. It can be very mild, or it can be really intense in screaming anger or in deep despair, to the point where you literally lose your mind because you just can't bear that terrible thing. This is attachment and aversion working 1,000 times a day. Miniature, tiny, underneath. Got to learn to catch it. And then, of course, because it's so subtle, when it builds up to strong emotion or to strong inertia of depression and despair, it's because we haven't dealt with it as and when it's happening. It builds up, you know. And then one day, the straw that broke the camel's back. It's hard, we're talking about trying to see this every second. It's very hard to do this. But if we understand it even theoretically. So that's why, in the most simple way, the most profound practice every day, it doesn't seem like it'll have an effect on your depression. It doesn't seem like it initially, or your anger for that matter, but it's profound. Is the second the attachment doesn't get what it wants. That second is the opportunity to practice. And what that means is, instead of resistance, greet it. Instead of resisting it, go towards it. Right there. That's the practice. If you do that all day, greeted the green red light. Greeted the unkind word. Instead of resisting it. Because what happens when you resist it, then the story starts in the head. And all the raging, you've written a novel in 10 minutes before you get to work, you know, and you're so stressed and can't cope. Because you didn't stop the head going crazy. But grab it right there. Grab it right there and greet it instead of resist it. That's accepting what attachment doesn't like instead of having aversion to it, which is how we do every day naturally. This sounds so tiny, but it is immense, I tell you. Because you build that habit up. You build up that habit instead of the habit of resistance until eventually it becomes so strong you can't cope. Because that second of the attachment not getting what he wants and the aversion rising, that's the moment of stress because they crash into each other. That's what stress is. It's why we have panic attacks and anxiety. All that is you've got all these balls in the air, all these jobs you have to do. And you know, this is how it is. You know, I know when I was like, whatever job, I did different jobs over the years, and one of the jobs, you know, a lot of busy things. When I was running the prison project, all these people to raise the money and the volunteers and the dramas and the prisoners and this and the that and the staff and the blah, blah, all the dramas, ordinary life, okay? We all got so many balls in the air. And one day, one night, you'd be tired, and I'd start checking over all the jobs, you know, and I'd go, I can't handle this. This is impossible. I can't do this. What am I doing? I'm out of my brain, I'd say to myself. And like panic attack. Wasn't really a panic attack, but you get my point. This is impossible. I can't do this. This is madness. What am I doing? I say to myself. I go to sleep, wake up next morning, I check the same things, and oh, that's all right. What was I worried about? Do you recognize that? The difference is your mind wasn't so grasping and you weren't so fearful, because fear is the nature of all these delusions. This is what's so interesting. Fear is their nature. You'll notice in Buddhist psychology, when you see the list of the different delusions, they don't list fear. Because the delusions themselves are rooted in fear. That's why it's painful. That's why we despair. That's why we go raging. That's why the head never stops. Fear, check the experience. Fear is the natural taste of all these neuroses. For catching the smallest, tiniest one. I'm discreet. Sounds so simple. And if you did that all day, guess what? By the end of the day, there'd be nothing to stress about because you've dealt with it as and when it came. Rather than just this default mode of raging and going on about it and then cursing and swearing to everybody else about it, which builds it all up, you know. Or going on in their head about it, never letting it go, like a dog with a bone. That thing that happened at 11 o'clock and you're still thinking about it at 6 o'clock and it's built up to the point of you're going crazy. Because we take it so, everything's so personal, so painful, because we're so fragile and nervous and worried and everything about ourselves, you know. The moment your attachment doesn't get what he wants, greet it, not resist it. It's okay. You know, patient people can do that. Patient people blow my mind. I can't believe they exist, but they do. When something happens, they go, oh, all right, oh, drat, you know, it's about the best, about the worst they get. In other words, they didn't resist it. They accepted, okay, the tea's not the way it is. That's okay, I can handle that, you know. With an angry person, how dare this, I wanted 180 degrees, this full milk, blah, blah, give it back, sup, blah, blah, you know, you understand? Oh, okay, it's all right, I can manage that, you know, that's fine. That's it. That's practicing patience, which is greeting the problem, which is greeting the tea you didn't want and knowing it's cool. In other words, you're changing your attitude. You're changing your interpretation. Attachment's interpretation is, I must get what I want. It's perfect. An angry interpretation is, how dare that tea be there? Well, it's cool. I can manage 160 degrees instead of 180, you know. Honestly, it sounds so simple. We know it's not simple, but this is the practice. Every day, this is the practice. Greeting the thing your attachment is desperately doesn't want, which is then when it becomes anger or aversion or fear or panic, you know. Bit by baby bit. It's neat, especially if we think of something really horrifying, you know, like a person that we just can't stand, that we have to have a meeting with, or the mean things that people do, and you have to confront it and talk to the person or do that thing you're just terrified to do. It is like fear. You can't bear the thought of it. Don't give in to that fear. Greet it. Do it. This is so hard. This sounds so simple. This is what practice is. This is real, on the ground, on the earth, in your face, daily practice. Okay, then it gets more tricky when you know, the Buddhist view would have it. When you have, I can think of a person, a friend of mine years ago, who had chronic, deeply ingrained, profound depression in bed for years. So sometimes, the way Buddhism would talk, of course, was the view of karma, that we come into this life programmed with billions of these, you know, the fruits of our past actions. That's what we are. That's how come we come into this life with a personality. Our mummy and daddy did not give it to us, Buddha would say. It's the fruit of our own past stuff. You know, we bring our own stuff with us, our anger, our love, our kindness, our generosity, you name it. And so one way our past karma manifests is, you know, when it's really deep ingrained, is either a person who comes up into this life who's insane, out of their brain, you know, hallucinating, completely deluded person, or a person with chronic physical illness since a tiny baby. Or this friend, deep depression, since she could remember, in a bed, couldn't get her body out of bed. So you can see with that kind of one, you can see the day-to-day way of dealing with things exacerbates it. But it's almost as if that itself, the pain or the depression, when it's very deeply ingrained, that itself is the fruit of a past karma, nothing in a sense to do with this life. You could almost say that, you know. So then it's very hard, much more hard to deal with. Much harder to deal with. There's no magic pill, you know. Drugs or anything don't help. And that's another interesting point too. We can see with taking some drugs, it can help the body, which then affects the mind. And that's not a contradiction at all. You know, because of the intimate relationship between the body and mind. So the Tibetan medical system, you know, you'd go to your Tibetan doctor and she'd feel your pulses because they have a very different model. They talk about we've got this subtle nervous system, this subtle wind energies coursing through all these nerves, like the Chinese meridian style. You know, it's a very different model of the body, how it functions. Very different way they talk. So she'll feel your pulses. She'll recognize an imbalance of the different wind energies and all these different kinds of winds, prana, in the body. And they know this. They can feel it very well. And they can feel an imbalance of these wind energies. So she, you know, and then as a result, you've got this anxiety. They call it lung. Lung just means wind. And it usually refers to there's an imbalance of the wind, you know. So then, because the mind and the body, the wind energies and the mind, which is coursing through the body, the way they talk about it, connected to all these winds, we're very susceptible to changes in our mind as a result of the physical changing. Like, it's obvious, isn't it? So you got this chemical imbalance, the West would call it. You take a certain drug, it alters the chemical imbalance. Because your mind is connected to that, your mind calms down. How marvelous. Go for it. Take your pills, please. Of course, some have other alternative side effects. You've got to be careful. But the same with your Tibetan doctor. She'll give you certain herbal medicines to take, which will help you fix the wind energies, which then in turn help your mind calm down. So mind and body are intimately connected. But the way the Buddhism would put it is, you change the physical part, and then the mental part has the space then to be different, you know. So if you do get depression, and it is panic and anxiety and all these things, then nothing wrong with taking a pill. But we've got to look carefully at that to see if there's other side effects that make, you know, because there often can be a downside, you know. So there's nothing wrong with that. It's great. Use whatever tools we can. Nothing wrong. Or change your lifestyle. Change. There's so many things we can do. Because the mind is the mind is the mind. And for the Buddha, that is the main point. But the external conditions, meaning the food, the people we live with, the house you live in, the job you have, the external world play a big role. And if our mind is that sensitive, that it responds in a neurotic way to certain external conditions, then first try and change the conditions. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. Because some people, we can be very sensitive to certain external conditions, you know. So change the condition, you can solve the problem. The mind is the point. So we have to know be very wise in the way we do things. Some people have much more sensitive energies, you know. They can respond really strongly to a certain physical thing. So you've got to know yourself well and do what's reasonable, you know. The mind is the point. But if we can change our physical condition and change the job, change the partner, change the food, go for it, baby. Do it. Don't sit there being a victim. But know in the end, by changing the physical environment, we can help our mind change then. We can see it more clearly, you know. Are we communicating here? I don't know if I'm answering any points that people have, but why don't you ask me some questions? 20 to 8. Ask me some questions. Yes, sweetheart. Yep. Yeah. Yes.
Well, about that point about changing some of this stuff. I mean, like I've had there's a period in my life where I've gone through depressive periods and I've had very dark thoughts.
Yes.
And then I found that taking small vitamins and something like that, they'll make them go away. And then
that helps your physical body, which gives you some physical energy, which helps can your mind be more positive.
But am I like relying too much on something external then? So
it's okay. Listen.
Yeah.
If you know. There's nothing wrong with relying on something external if it's going to be helpful to us.
Okay.
But, only when everything becomes a problem is when it becomes addictive, which is attachment. When we really believe I'm nothing until I have the cake in my mouth. Mm. If I really believe I'm nobody until you smile at me, then we can say definitely we've got a problem there.
Okay.
So as long as we know the mind is the point, we need to give ourselves the conditions that allow our mind, like you said, dark thoughts. Give ourselves a different condition so the mind isn't so dark. As long as we know the mind is playing a role and you use that opportunity to see your mind more clearly and help work on it, then eventually when you've really worked on your mind, that same physical condition won't upset you anymore.
Okay.
So it's sensible. It's practical. Don't be fundamentalist about it. It's great.
Okay.
If you're in too much pain, take a pill, baby. Don't be fundamentalist, you know. But the key is, though, to see now you've got the space to see your mind more clearly, and that's the real work. It's brilliant. Marvelous. Go for it. How fortunate you can change the physical condition. Some people can't, you know. It's great. Someone else? Yeah, at the back. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sometimes, I guess my question would be...
A bit close to the mic, I think. You need to be close to it. Just in your mouth, close, like an ice cream.
Okay.
Yeah, get close.
I guess my question is how to determine between healthy dislike and unhealthy aversion. For instance, if I was very thirsty and I wanted a drink of water and I tasted it and it was salt water and I know that's not good to drink the salt water, and I can't accept that.
No, that's not dislike, that's intelligence.
Okay. But
intelligence is this ability in your mind to discriminate between salty water and plain water, which is just as well you've got it, otherwise you'd be dead in a minute, you know. So that's called intelligence. But our assumption is, and this is what's interesting, our assumption is the second you taste something that isn't what you wanted, we assume you get angry. But that's the part you're changing. So it's not even a healthy dislike. That's called intelligence and discrimination. But you can recognize there's a murderer with a gun coming. You better get out of his way. Not to be freaking out and having a panic attack. That's the part that's different.
Okay.
You see, that's called intelligence. In other words, if it's instead of anger, let's say, you see the world as a suffering place. You've got to see that. That's not being angry. That's intelligence. The world is a suffering place. But we think, oh, well, I've got to be angry now. That's the part we have to change. And that's a huge door opening. Then we get braver to see the thing and welcome it. When I said welcome it before, I don't mean, oh, wow, I'm so happy there's so much suffering. That doesn't. It means seeing it without having a mental breakdown, noticing it's salty water, noticing my tea isn't the right temperature, noticing the suffering in the world without a mental breakdown, which is where the delusion kicks in. We're trying to change the deluded response, and we don't tend to think that that's a choice. Because we assume it's normal to freak out if it's salty water. It's normal to get angry if we're sad. It's normal to get upset if your tea isn't right. That's the revolution we have to see. Then we can realize we can change the way we respond and therefore recognize it's this, recognize it's suffering, recognize it's salty water, but your mind can be as stable as can be when you've really developed. That's the miracle. You see my point?
I do.
It's a major point.
Thank you.
Okay. What else? People. Yes.
You was talking about...
A bit close to the mic, sweetie. You can't hear so well.
You was talking about greeting the aversion.
Greeting the object that triggers the aversion is the meaning I'm saying.
Right. Okay. So
greeting the thing that would normally you think is the cause of your aversion or fears or panic, yeah.
Okay. So I was facing a situation where I had an...
Sit down, relax. Sit down and get close to the mic.
Where I had an attachment to an individual that lived in an aversive state. So
they were angry.
Right. And
you were attached to this person.
Right. So though I was facing, going in, I knew like on a daily basis that I would face the aversion aspect.
So I'm a bit confused.
Okay.
So here's a person that you're attached to,
right,
but they're an angry mother. Is that what you're saying? I'm confused.
No, not necessarily angry.
Sorry, what's the problem then? What's their problem?
Unclear. They had an unclear mind and lived in a negative state.
Okay, very unhappy, deluded person.
Right.
But you're attached to this person.
Right. So
what do you mean by attached to this person, sweetheart?
Wanting happiness for them.
Oh, but that's not attachment. That's kindness. That's generosity. That's compassion. What do you mean kindness, happiness for them? You want them to be happy.
Right.
That's called compassion, Petal.
Right.
Not attachment. Give yourself a break. That's called compassion.
But
you want them to be happy. So go on, where's the problem? I'm a bit confused.
Okay, because I knew that they... I kind of went into this... On a daily basis, I kind of went into it knowing that there was going to be both wanting happiness for them and having this...
expectation that they should respond and get happy.
Partially. But knowing that they were unhappy and that I was going to have to face that unhappy aspect.
Oh, okay. So then?
So, would I be greeting the aversive state?
You're greeting... No, okay. The point is... I'll tell you how to look if you didn't have attachment and aversion. How you'd be would be, you'd see this person, they're a friend, you've got a connection, they've got suffering, you want them to be happy. And you're thinking, how can I make them happy? So you know you're going to be seeing them, and the thing is, if you didn't have attachment or aversion, whatever they responded, and in whatever way it was, you'd see it really clearly, but you wouldn't be having expectations, you wouldn't be worried, you wouldn't be nervous, you wouldn't get upset, you wouldn't have fear, and you wouldn't be disappointed. You'd do what you can for them, and then with no expectations. And then very often when we're like this, then you just, you know, it's okay. Nothing's wrong. So if we get all caught up and knotted inside, it's because of attachment and neediness and I wish they'd change and why don't they change and if only they shouldn't change and all the dramas, you know. Are you seeing what I'm saying, sweetie?
Yes.
So just if you can imagine how you'd be without attachment and aversion, you'd be steady, you'd be kind, you'd be easygoing, but you wouldn't kind of try to change them all the time. You'd accept who they are. You'd accept them for who they are without worry. And if they do change, great, that's a bonus. If they don't, that's cool, that's who they are. It wouldn't upset us. So another person's suffering upsets us because we have attachment to them being different. And then we get all caught up and needy and want them to be different, and our attachment then pollutes our compassion. And then we make a mess. Do you understand?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you're looking well anyway. You doing well? You look very well.
I am.
You're doing well. You look like you're doing well. I'm very pleased. Good. He's an old friend. Go on, someone else. Yeah. This stuff sort of sounds easy. These words, attachment, aversion, sound so normal, sound boring. They sound so unsophisticated. But it just goes to real subtle levels, I tell you, you know. Yeah.
So one area of attachment that I've always struggled with, I just wonder, Kidney Thoughts, is fatigue, lack of sleep, being tired.
Yes.
And, you know, start telling yourself stories and kind of, you know, just go down that hole. And I just, that's one area where I've struggled with kind of letting that go and saying, hey, I'm just tired, just be okay with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's, I think, yeah. You see, that just proves the attachment, the desperate craving to feel comfortable. I mean, we certainly have nervous breakdowns and we get tired. But it isn't because we're tired that we get nervous breakdown. It's we get anxious about it. And if only, I'm going to miss out on my sleep and this is no good. It's the actual anxiety. Because you'd look, if you're in love with somebody, you'll spend all night talking to them. And you'll be walking to go to work next day completely exhausted but blissful because you didn't get upset about it. So that's the point. There's nothing wrong with it. It's only the body, you see. When you remember that. You spend all night dancing and on, you know, drinking and happy. Your mind's happy because you're in love with someone. You don't care being exhausted. So it's the caring about, which is the attachment again. So you say, when you have like fatigue or something, it's unnatural kind of fatigue or something?
No, it's just when it's been a late night, you know, didn't sleep enough or, you know, haven't been sleeping as much as I usually do or that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, you've got to, I mean, is there underlying? I'm not trying to be too personal in public. It's not underlying stuff. It's just because you got to bed late or something.
Usually work stuff.
Work, yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, it's a stress about it, isn't it? So then, yeah, that's. It's the resistance of it, which is the annoyance and the anger. Is it to do with blaming other people, expecting you to work so long? Is all the resentment in there too? Is that part of the trip?
I can usually find somebody to blame.
There you go. That's the one, isn't it? Well, you feel a bit like a victim or no one appreciates all the hard work you're doing. I mean, you're getting paid for all this extra work?
No.
That's why. If you're getting a fat bonus, these guys who get these fat bonuses. I read somewhere recently in all this banking world, they work 120 hours a week. Because they got their millions at the end, baby. We'd do anything, you know. I remember even reading about some fellow in the finance world who slept 3 hours a day. He was so gung-ho on his job. They work 7 days a week, and they're on call 24 hours a day. But they get the bonuses that fit, you know. So we sit there feeling miserable and self-piteous. That's part of the problem, too. We don't feel appreciated all this hard work, especially if you're working for someone else. You're not motivated for your own self, you know. If it's someone else and you feel resentful, so it's not just depression, it's not just tiredness. It's also annoyed, resentful, not appreciated, upset, which is anger. There's so many tricky things going on in there, you know. And that's where we have to look into our own choices. And that's where we feel like victims. If we really feel that we are in charge of our own life, which is one of the most powerful things we need to do, then if you have to work the 100 hours a week, you've got to do it because you've chosen, not because you think someone expects it. That's the victim talking. When we've chosen, it's when we've chosen to do it, then we grow up and we don't get upset. We have to choose our options, but we don't mostly feel this way. Whatever it is, we always feel like it's being done to us. We feel victims, you know. It's not fair. You've got to go visit some ugly old grandma you can't stand or your old auntie, and you're resentful the whole time. But the fact is, if you're going to go, you've got to choose to go, therefore you'll be happy when you're there. This is massive, actually. And that's another way of saying greeting it. You make a decision. You're the boss. So whether you stay in that job or whether you go, either way, you choose to do one or the other. And that's what taking responsibility means. And that stops guilt, depression, fear, annoyance, anger, and resentment. Because we always feel like victims. And that's the opposite to accountability. Even if you're feeling poor and miserable and you can't change your job, there's no point in feeling sorry for yourself, and I'm not being mean here. If you can change the job, then you change the job. But if you can't, even though you'd like to, at least try to be happy doing it by accepting this is the job I'm doing, and I'm going to make the most of it, and I'm going to try and be happy doing it. That's another way of saying you choose to do it, rather than doing it because you think you've got no choice. That's so much of ordinary daily suffering. It's feeling like you're in charge of your life. Even my friends in prison, it's the same. You're in prison. You can't change. You might as well be happy. That's what I mean by greeting the problem. I am in prison. I cannot get out of prison. I will in 30 years, or I might never get, or I'm going to be dead in whatever. There are people who've got life sentences, and they've done everything, and they cannot get out of prison. Then you will go mad, which is typical and normal, and I'm not surprised. It's so hard when you realize you will never get out alive. But the ones who really are doing well are the ones who it's like they've chosen. This is where I am. This is my life. I'm going to make the most of it. That's owning. That's what accountability means. This is actually profound. And another way of saying greeting the problem and saying it's fine. It's huge. But we don't have a choice. You see, this is the irony. We're not in prison, but we act like we're in prison. We act like we have no freedom. We think we have freedom, but we're acting like we have no freedom all the time because we're always moaning and complaining, getting upset and resentful and not fair, poor me. Do you get my point?
Yeah.
Good. There's the problem, baby girl. Baby boy, not girl. You see, this is typical, ordinary. We're not talking suffering of being in a war zone here. We're not talking about even suffering of being in a prison. We're talking ordinary people like you and me who are living in the 1% of the world who are so fortunate. But look at our poor suffering minds, you know. Do you understand? You've got money in the bank, you get mortgages, you get credit cards, you've got friends, and look at our miserable old minds. You get my point?
Yes.
Don't you? It's hard. It sounds easy, but hey, it's hard. Because life is tough. So we have to grow up and take responsibility. But this is not easy, but this is the way to put it. It's not easy, but it's greeting it and accepting it. If you choose to do it. If you don't, then baby, don't do it. We have to say that to ourselves. It's annoying. It's frustrating because we'd rather feel it's not my choice, it's not my fault, therefore the resentment. This is a very powerful function of ego. Ego loves to blame. It's not fair, you know. And that's how we all feel. You understand? Be brave, baby.
Thank you.
You can do it. Someone else.
What's the best way if you live with someone that you suspect has a mental illness?
You mean a mental illness more than we've all got?
Yeah, like
you mean
someone who is you feel is very delusional, very angry, very combative.
Okay.
It speaks about plots that they think other people
okay,
are
okay, quite
running
seriously,
their
life. Bit paranoid.
Yes. And,
okay.
And they're an adult child.
Okay, darling, I understand
and
you.
And it's a constant struggle, I mean,
yeah.
Every day to just face this person.
But I have to ask you to answer the question of what the relationship is. Are you their mother?
Yes.
Well, then that's quite intense, baby.
It is very intense.
Sweetheart.
So what's the best way to handle that? I mean,
well,
you know you can't throw them out of the house because you know they're not going to fly.
How old are they?
27.
I see. And just being practical now, there's nothing you can do to help them.
No, I've tried.
Every type of method.
I've tried, and it turns out that it's more I blame you because this is what I think you've done to me. And it all comes back on me.
Right. Of course it does, yes.
And so I only have skillful means to sometimes just to listen.
No, but let me ask a bit more questions.
And then I got to leave.
No, I understand. So let me ask more questions. This person,
okay.
Are they that insane that they couldn't live on their own? Are they really, really seriously delusional that they'd kill themselves or other people if they lived on their own?
No, I think
just ordinary deluded, ordinary paranoid. You mean ordinary blaming?
Well,
mom.
I mean, they really, there's some issues there where they think other people are controlling their lives and that there's a plot that no one wants to have them happy, and the people are hacking into their accounts.
It's seriously deluded,
It's serious. Enough to know that
I understand.
As long as I can support her, she could possibly live on her own, but I don't want to do that for the rest of my life.
This person doesn't leave home because?
Because she can't get a job. Because as soon as she goes for an interview, people pick up on these things.
I see. So quite mentally ill, quite suffering.
So there's
so
a lot
what,
going
so
on.
So do you feel, so the same as him, do you feel you have a choice here? And I'm not trying to be horrible. Do you feel you have choices?
Sometimes I
You've
feel
made
like
the
I
choice
do.
To have her in your house.
Right. I did make that choice.
You've made. I'm asking, have you made that choice? You've really made that choice. I will support her as long as she needs me. Have you made that choice?
Yes.
I'm asking seriously.
Yes.
That is a choice you really know you've made.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's just difficult because...
Is this person... So, she's your own daughter?
Yes.
Your blood daughter?
Yes.
You love this person? I'm not... It's
not
personal. You bring this stuff up. We've got to ask these questions.
I know.
Do you have affection for her?
Oh, absolutely.
You
absolutely
do have affection
do.
For her. You want her to be happy?
Yes.
You have compassion for her?
I do.
Is she wretched to be around?
She's very disruptive and yes...
She's in the house?
Yes.
Makes trouble?
And can turn a situation that's
sure.
nice... just right. like that.
Exactly, darling.
Her own brothers don't want to be around.
No, I believe you, darling. It's
so
very heartbreaking.
How do you deal?
Very, very heartbreaking. So sad. And there's nothing you can do to help her, like drugs. There's no drugs. You've got no psychiatrist.
Well, she doesn't want to. So my point is, what do I do?
I know your point. I'm just telling you other things, practical things.
Okay.
About helping her. But you can't. There's nothing you can do. To help her is what I'm saying. I'm asking that question first. So you know there's nothing more you can do. Well, then now we get to the answer to your question. Having covered all the beds, covered all the options, this is the painful practice you've got in life. This extraordinary... I mean, do you have the Buddhist view in life?
Yes.
Karma, all this business?
I'm wondering what karma...
I know, it's
I
a very intense relationship, darling. I mean, we've all got that. We've all got that with whoever we're living with, and which is, you know, when you look at the suffering of... I was, you know, the suffering of the relationships of close people, the families and partners who kill each other, all this kind of business. I mean, it's pretty intense on this earth.
So what, is it fair to say that I harmed her?
Oh, there's no question. There's no question. That's the karma, the logic
that's
of karma,
it.
You know. There's this history between you. You've got this strong history. She got born in your womb, sweetheart. And her own dreadful mental suffering, her own unhappy, sad, unhappy mind, full of rage and paranoia, absolute, total, 100% victim, which is what anger comes from. Anger and paranoia, to her degree, is 100% self-pity victim. Join the club. But hers is just extreme and immovable.
That's not then, comforting.
No, I know, darling. But then, it's just, I mean, do you have a life? You have a life, right, besides her?
Yes.
You have a job and you have other people in your life?
Yes.
You have a partner as well, the father of this person?
Yeah, we're on the same page.
Okay. Well, then, you know, one of the things, I will tell you this one, okay? One of the things you should maybe do is you and your husband decide never talk about her. Never criticize her. Never discuss her. 90% of your problems will go away. I'm not kidding. I mean, maybe not 90%.
Well, it's
because that's what keeps the fire burning. Your expect all the time you moan, you complain, you criticize. That is all the time an assumption there that she should be different. Whereas if you were truly welcoming whatever she is, that means there'd be no problem. You just know that's who she is. It's like she only had one leg, and you're forever complaining because she doesn't go up the stairs properly, doesn't go down the stairs, and she only wears blah, 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 ever complaining about only having one leg. This is who she is, sweetheart. You've chosen to support her. You've chosen her to be in your life. So then, one, shut the mouth. And I really, do an exercise for a week and not say one word about her. And in your heart, love her. In your heart, accept her junk. In the heart, just be the way she is. Avoid her if you have to. That's okay. Keep out of her way. But make a decision just not to say one bad word for 1 week or even 24 hours. I think you're going to see a difference in your own mind.
She took off to Indonesia.
When is that? What do you mean? She's gone now.
Yeah, she left.
Well, you haven't got a proper anymore. What are you taking?
But
now you completely throw me.
But it's a little unsettling because, you know, we never know where she is and she's not very safe. I mean...
Now we have a... But that's another problem.
Yeah.
So now we... next chapter, you have another problem now, which is called worry and... Worry. Sweetheart. I'm completely gobsmacked.
Well, that's that.
Oh, darling, I'm not trying to trivialize it. I'm not trying to trivialize it.
I know. But, you know, if you don't laugh about it...
I know, dear.
It'd kill you.
Well, I would suggest, but still try this one. Because she's 27. This is who she is. You've done everything in your power to help her change. You haven't been successful. So you've got to let... You've got to, you need to say the words. You just maybe don't talk about her. You can maybe do prayers for her. Have the Buddhas pray for her. Do kind of things like that. But don't go on about her anymore. Stop that. That will be a profound change in your mind. Mm-hmm. And have the just you know, but if she has not doesn't work, how can she support herself in Indonesia? If she has no money.
She's taken the money that we give her to pay her bills and took off and to a bottom.
But how much money does she get to go to Indonesia?
She can live pretty cheap in Indonesia.
Well, honey, be happy for her that she's made a decision to go.
Well, we are. I
good.
Mean, it's
well then
nice.
Okay. Well then still the same exercise. Stop talking about her and stop criticizing her.
Okay, I will do.
This is who she is.
Okay.
As sad as it is, this is who she is. If there is something you can do to help, do it. But stop criticizing. I swear to you, that will solve a lot of your problems. And just have affection and kindness and say mantras and have prayers done and then let it be and let karma take care. It's not being rude or indifferent. It's practical.
Thank
there's
you.
No benefit in worry and fears and anger. There's no benefit in feeding you and the two of you together, blah, 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 about it the whole time. That's what exhausts you. That's what drags you down. And I don't have any guilt. You didn't cause it. It's her own mind, you know. If you did do something naughty to her, you have to confess that and try and change. But if you didn't, which you know you didn't, it's her mind. This is the tragedy, you know. So accept and love her for who she is and hope every day she's fine and have the Buddha take care of her and meanwhile don't talk about her. Stop that in the negative, typical way. Like we all do, our, you know, alcoholic brother, the nutty old friend, the old auntie. We love to go blur, blur, blur. And that is so much of the problem. Do you understand?
Yes, totally.
Good. Okay, well done.
Thank you.
Yes. Down here. This gentleman down there.
Oh.
Hi.
Yeah, hi there.
I just wanted to say, like, one of the things that, like, I constantly deal with is letting go of something in my past or in my life. And
something naughty you've done, you mean?
Not naughty, no. let's just say a friend.
Okay.
And like, I don't know how to, like, let it go out of my mind, out of my heart, out of my spirit, out of my soul, out of my being, out of everything that I am.
Darling. I understand.
Out of everything that I possess. And, like, you know, I just want to be done with it.
I understand, darling. So I need to ask, though, is this, were you mean to this person, or this person has been mean to you and has rejected you? What's the scenario? Then I can answer better.
To hear it from my point of view, this person has...
Okay, all I can do is your point of view.
This person has abandoned me.
They've abandoned you?
Yes.
Okay. So they stopped loving you.
From my point of view,
so they stopped loving you?
Yes. And I can't accept it. I want to accept it. And it's like, I need to know why.
I need
some closure for me.
I understand.
And the fact that I can't put anything in front of it, behind it, on sides of it.
No, I understand.
It has to be dealt with.
I understand.
I can't accept anything
else. Is this old or is this fairly recent?
Maybe 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
It's still new.
I understand, darling.
In my mind.
So this person, are they still mad at you? Or you feel that they're out of your life now?
I don't know.
Okay,
because
fine.
I can't receive that.
Okay.
Mentally, physically,
okay, well,
or
you know,
spiritually.
That's the painful part for you then is this wishing. Somehow we feel, I really feel we think when something like that happens, that somehow we think, what did I do wrong? What went wrong? Well, the Buddhist view about karma would say not necessarily anything whatsoever. Sometimes a relationship is like you put a certain amount of gas in the tank, it's got a certain life, and it'll run out. It'll just run out. And maybe the karma has just finished, but because you're, you know, because you're maybe still attached and still want the person to love you, and then because of that, you're feeling pain from it, like as if they're accusing you, and you feel so painful. That's the problem. There's nothing wrong with relationships finishing, but we take it so personally. Maybe you didn't do anything wrong. It's just the karma finished, is the way to say it. And it's your neediness. We're all the same, sweetheart. Your neediness. We all have the deepest attachment is of other people approving of us. So when a person gives us up, we feel like it's like a knife in the heart.
Yes. And
that's the pain.
I'm one of those 80-something-something-something people that, you know, I get to the edge and, you know,
darling.
Nothing satisfies me. But
I understand, darling.
The smell of death. You
yeah,
know,
I
like
hear
I,
you,
I don't want to be here
no,
for
I
nothing.
Don't. I understand, sweetheart. So then, it sounds so easy to say it, but the point is, and this is the point the Buddhism is saying, and I mean, I feel like this one gives me confidence, that no matter how bad things are, no matter how bad I see my own rubbish, that isn't who I really am. It doesn't define me. You have so much potential. You have such a good heart. You are so intelligent. You've got so much goodness. And we forget about that because one person gave us up. And then we take that as a terrible personal insult, as if that's saying you're nothing. But it's not saying you're nothing. It's their problem.
But I believe, like, in the highest of the highest, and something I feel should have been taking care of me is not to go in that direction.
Like, which
I
direction?
I just felt like I should have been sheltered. I should have been cared for whatever's out here. I don't know if you understand
sheltered
it, but I
sheltered by whom?
Sheltered by unnecessary pain.
By whom? Who should have been doing the sheltering?
I don't know. It doesn't matter who should do it.
No, it doesn't. It's a really good point, actually.
It doesn't matter. So no, I just feel like I live in a world where, you know, I'm one of those people with aversion that I can't deal with hate. I can't deal with none of that because when it's thrown my way, I'm even worse than that.
I understand.
You know, and so I need to know, or not even know that, you know, that I was cared for or that I made a right decision even when the forces or whatever was behind that didn't take care of me.
Who? Okay, maybe then. It sounds good what you're saying, but what in the what if we don't get that expectation fulfilled? What is the choice? Then maybe we have to learn to do it for ourselves and become fulfilled in ourselves and become the amazing person that we are and learn to not expect it from other people because that's what injures us. And there's this expectation, but based on what, you know? We have to maybe have to turn around and do that to other people instead of thinking other people should do it to us. If we give it to others and love others and take care of others and shelter others and take that responsibility, that makes us powerful.
I've done that a lot, and sometimes I'm truly hurt by people who don't accept it.
I understand that,
or people who won't claim it, or people who think that I'm different. But I have a love that's so deep and strong, you know, that some people will deny it, and it hurts to be denied.
I understand that.
Whatever truth that you have to give,
I understand.
Inside of yourself, the real truth,
that's
the real love.
So then we have to keep going, and you keep moving, and be really cautious, and protect yourself, and you know, pray every day, and you will meet eventually people who will see you, who will appreciate you, and will return that love. We have to protect ourselves until then, because the world is a very suffering place, sweetheart. But be brave and never give up. Okay? Does that make sense? Good, darling.
Venerable Rabina, could I talk about that a little bit?
You can have a private conversation. You can have a private conversation later.
Because
it's okay. You can have a private conversation later. If you have a question, ask me the question.
I'll ask a question.
Okay, good, darling.
I was devastated when I was about this young lady's age.
Yes.
I had a dear, dear friend.
Yes.
I think it's very important. Still, I couldn't, for years, I couldn't understand what happened.
Right.
We were so dear, so friendly.
So what's the question?
Okay, I found out years ago that she was jealous of me. I became engaged.
That's fine.
I got a promotion. We worked together. I got a diamond ring. She just started talking to me.
I understand, darling.
So
I understand.
People will never satisfy you.
I understand. Thank you so much.
Just to let you know.
Thank you, sweetheart. Thank you. Who else would like to say something? Ask something. The days keep getting shorter. It's only 8:15. Come on, who else? Who else has a question? Or go something to more. We can talk. Are we? Okay, go. Yes.
So, does this work? Okay. So then, as you work on the things that you were talking about, like accepting the bad feelings or the aversion and that sort of thing.
I've been quite specific.
Mm-hmm.
Accepting the thing that occurs, the word, the person, the event, the mean thing, or this, rather than resisting it but greeting it.
Yes.
That's the
point. Then do the negative self-thoughts lesson?
Yes, of course. That's the point. Slowly, slowly, sweetheart. Subtly, subtly. Slowly, slowly. Yes. But it goes real deep. I'm not trying to make it sound easy. You know, but the negative thoughts is one of the typical ways that aversion or anger work. We turn it against ourselves. You know, it's so easy for us, and this is a dissatisfaction. The default mode, the second something goes wrong, is we find fault with ourselves. I remember the Dalai Lama hearing about the way in our culture we have so much self-hate, self-criticism, dissatisfaction with ourselves. He said it's a mental illness, and it is. We should be crying and compassion for ourselves, and we're addicted to it. This is a tragedy. You know yourself. We're dying for other people to praise us and love us and like us and see us. And even when they do, we kind of don't believe it. 27 people can tell you they love you. One person says they don't. Look whom we believe. You understand? It's kind of ironic, isn't it? And this is something for you too, darling. We are so hurt inside our hearts, you know, that because we're so injured and so hurt and put ourselves down, we keep seeing and hearing the bad things to reinforce our own bad view. Because if it isn't, let's say a person says, you know, they say a thought that you agree with, that you're a creep. And then you blame them for it, because actually it's you already thinking it. Because if it weren't true, you wouldn't. It wouldn't matter they said it. It wouldn't matter. So we have to, like, we have to reprogram our thoughts. You know, we have to start literally just saying positive things about ourselves. It sounds so corny, but it's really profound, because we are addicted to finding fault, thinking I'm no good, and then we meet the things out there that seem to reinforce it. You know, it's long. We've got to be in for the long haul. But it's not even a question of will the negative thoughts change. We have to actively change them. It's like your head's got all these scripts, isn't it? And all the negative scripts, all the bad, all the crazy roommates, all doing their story. What's your name?
Emily.
Emily's this and Emily's that, and I'm this and I'm that, and I'm this and I'm that. You've got to start bringing the good guys out. Well, excuse me, no, I don't think Emily's that bad after all. I think Emily's quite kind. She's pretty intelligent. She's this and that. But we don't listen to those ones. We don't even let them have a word. We just tell them to shut up and go back to the bad ones. So don't just hope that our bad ones will change. Proactively say the good ones. And I'm not kidding. They call it rejoicing. It sounds so sort of holy. It's quite profound, actually. Do you understand? To actively. Are there a few good things you do? You're quite a nice person. You don't run around killing and raping too many people, do you?
No.
You're fairly intelligent.
Yes.
You've got a good heart.
Mm-hmm.
You mean well. You're trying to be a better person. Yeah. You're trying to control your behavior, not harm other people. Well, you should be weeping in tears of joy at yourself. Right there. Do you see? It sounds so simple, but it's profound. But we don't. We only remember and notice the things we don't do. That's why we get so pained and so hurt, you know. So not just hope the negative ones change, actively say the positive ones. And I really seriously mean this, but they don't come automatically to us. The only time we think good things about ourselves is like, oh, I'm really better than they think I am. It's all offended and hurt and, you know, painful. It's not like positive and upbeat. You understand? We're so stupid. Who else?
Sometimes I feel like what I did in the service, things,
the service?
Military.
Okay,
right. Like you said, I'm not running around killing people, but what if I was?
That's okay.
And how do I look back at that? I mean, yeah. Some people will look at
what service were you in?
The Navy.
Okay, what did you do in the Navy?
I was an attack pilot.
A who?
A fighter pilot.
And what do you do? What do they do, attack pilots?
I bomb people.
Bomb people,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
You bombed a few people?
A few, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Go on.
And so sometimes it's hard for me to look at myself. Because,
I see.
You know, if I take responsibility to say, okay, I chose to do that.
Yes.
Right, because I did. I chose to
yes.
do that.
Sure.
And now that's not really
how
what
do you feel about that now?
I feel bad about it now.
What was your motivation then?
Service to the country. And,
okay, so yeah. It was a noble one. Defending
supposedly.
Your enemies, that kind of thing.
Right.
Did you have anger in your mind about the killing people? Were you happy to kill people?
No.
Well, okay. So then you've got to... You see, karma, it's interesting, we talk about karma now. Karma, which is this Buddhist view of how things happen and what we are, just a word used to refer to what our mind does every day and how it programs us. So as soon as you answer those questions, like if you'd said, well, you know, I really enjoyed the killing and I wish I'd kill more people and I really think these are creeps and I'd love to go back and kill more, well, you wouldn't be in this room if you were saying that. Then you'd say, okay, you created quite heavy negative karma because your intention was to kill and you wanted to harm people and you were glad. Well, you didn't say that. You knew you were killing people. It was your job. You know, had some connection with it to do this job, but your nobility to help others was there, and then somehow you got the job and you had to drop bombs. Okay, you did it, now you've stopped. So then this is where purification of karma is so powerful, and this is really a practice. Maybe we'll talk about that now because we've got the time. This is a kind of practice, as Lama Zopa says, we're insane not to do this every day. Because the more we understand the Buddha's teachings, if we choose to, you know, understand this process of what it is that causes us to be born into this world as this person, with that mummy, with that daddy, in this world, in this life, taking that job as a part, whatever it is, to have a daughter like yours. It's no accident, Buddha says. Everything is like we've got this strong history. One of the ways karma ripens is we've got this strong history with each other. We keep coming back into the same groups and here you go, you meet your wretched old daughter again. God knows what you did to a girl, you know. But at least you got a decent mummy this time, lucky her. And then you got, you know, whatever, what's your name?
Scott.
And what's your name down the end there, sweetheart? What's your name? Tracy. So there's Tracy. Let's say there's some strong karmic history with this particular person she's talking about. And that's why it can be so painful sometimes, even though it might be a short relationship. It seems so painful, the break in that relationship. It's like some people never heal from the breaks in some relationships, you know, because the history with each other is so intense. So you can deduce you've got some history with even the people you bombed. There's some karmic history from the past, you know. A fisherman has history with all those fish who come running to his nets. There's a really powerful, this is what they mean by karmic connection. The Buddha would say this is just how it is, not some cosmic idea. It's not accidental you get born to this life, that Tracy had that mummy or that friend or you got that daughter. You've got history with each other. You kind of like, hi there. That rat's in your house. They're your rats, baby. The lice in your head, they're your lice. Welcome home lice, you know. We've got this history with all these sentient beings. And then due to our past actions, because karma just means intention. On the basis of a thought, then the body and speech will carry out the wishes. But what motivates the intention is the real character of the action, you know? So we come into this life, and karma ripens in four ways for the Buddhist view. The first one, and there's millions of karmic imprints in our little bank vault. Every single thing we think and do and say leaves a little impression or a seed in our mind. We've got these trillions of these seeds. And we can deduce our being human. There's Tracy, you know, who are you again?
Scott,
thank you, Scott. Tracy, Scott, you know. What's your name? Louise. Oh, it's my second name. Rabina Louise. Anyway, there's Louise and Tracy and Scott, you know. Where was I? Yeah, okay. You come into, so that we can deduce more than a few, not more than a few weeks before you zapped into your mummy's womb, Tracy. We can say that you, at the time of your past death, let's say you were a human, you'd practice a spiritual path, you'd be a good person, you'd practice morality, you knew about impermanence, you're heading towards death, and the way you died, which would have been fairly peaceful, that peaceful mind would have triggered one of the billions of karmic seeds that ripened, became the one, Tracy, that would program your consciousness. And by the time it left the body, and a few weeks later, you found yourself born in your mummy's womb in this country or whatever. No accident about it. You've got the life you've got, the mother you've got, the father you've got, the environment you've got, the kind of person you are, how people see you, if they're mean to you, if they're ugly to you. So not only the life you get, but all your tendencies and all the people you're going to meet. It's the third one. All your experiences, they say. All the people you meet, are they nice ones, the ugly ones, the mean ones, the crazy daughters, the kind friends, the ugly friends, whatever it is. We've got this history with each other, and we keep bumping into each other again and again and again, you know. And then we act out our ridiculous past rubbish. That's why we've got to change the stuff we've got. Change it, purify it, finish it, right? So there's four ways our karma ripens. The type of rebirth we get, then all our tendencies and our personality, your poor daughter, whatever delusions are in her mind from the past, her mind's so deluded now she's imagining things that don't exist. Buddha says we're all delusional. It just is a question of degree. Obviously hers is more suffering, you know. The third kind of karma is called experiences similar to the cause. Or the people, the way they see you, they like you, don't like you, love you, reject you, hate you, take care of you, rape you, whatever it might be. This is due to strong history, you know, with other sentient beings. So the Buddha would say that's how it is for all sentient beings, all the ants, all the rats, all the ants, all the dogs, all the humans. We're acting out this stuff. It's not punishment, it's not reward, no one does it to us. We program ourselves with this stuff. I mean, it's a pretty intense view, but it's kind of interesting. You've got to admit, it means we are really responsible. We did it. No one did it to us. We didn't choose this life in the sense of volition, really saying, I want to be born a maniac. No. But due to our past actions, those seeds ripened as these present fruits. The type of person we are, the type of intentions, and all the experiences, and even the way the environment impacts upon us, you know? So this is the way karma is, and so therefore, if whatever we experience, as Lama Zopa puts it, is my karmic appearance, whatever I'm meeting, Tracy and these mean people not taking care of her, not looking after her, whatever it is, you know, your crazy daughter, your people you killed in the whatever, there's karma there with these people. So if all of that's the fruit of our past actions, and then we sit back and we think, okay, fundamental state, do I want to be happy or do I want to suffer? We all know we answer, I want to be happy, I don't want to suffer. Well, Buddha says, cool, here's my method. First of all, every moment of suffering you have in this life, you can deduce it's the fruit of a negative seed you planted in the past. So in that sense, you help to take responsibility. Rather than thinking, I'm an innocent victim who didn't ask to get born, and mummy did it, daddy did it, God did it, somebody else did it. Not my fault, baby. Not like that. Buddha says, sorry, Rabina. You created your own garden. Your life is your garden. What's in your garden is your weeds and your flowers. You're responsible for both. And what's fascinating here is, you know, we agonize about why bad things happen. We never agonize about why good things happen. Why are good things happening to me, you know? We never worry about that one. It's only the bad ones. Because we have this view, I don't deserve it. But I definitely deserve the good ones, you know? And in a way, Tracy's story, which is so painful, we've all got that one. We've all got that one, you know? So anyway, if what I'm experiencing is the fruit of what I've done before, and then I take stock of my garden, and I do I like all the weeds? Do I like the garbage? Do I like the crazy daughters? Do I like the mean people? No, I don't, honey. Well, they are mine. I created it by doing this kind of thing. How am I going to change it? So you start assessing it differently. It's the fruit of your own past actions, already responsibility. Then I'm going to want to make sure I pull out the weeds best I can, but don't sow more crazy weeds in my garden. So what's the basis there? I have suffering now. Not complicated. Buddhist morality is pretty straightforward, you know. If people harm me, it's because I'll harm them. I mean, it sounds so cosmic and simplistic in a way. But Buddha says this is not is a natural law that just occurs. Of course, in the Buddhist literature, it's talked about immense length in all the literature and quite subtle, the actual technology of it, you know. This is simple principles here we're talking about. But the consequence of this view, a person who wants to be a Buddhist, is this enormous sense of ownership. Not victim, not innocent, not fair. It's like the not fair one is so deep inside us. But we own responsibility for our situation, my own tendencies, the experiences, what people do to me. And then we know, okay, I'm going to bear these fruits. I grew them. They're in my garden a bit deeper than down. I can't pull them out overnight. So I'm going to interpret them differently. They're mine. And I'm going to make sure I stop killing other people. I stop lying. I stop stealing. I stop this. I stop that. Pretty simple. And I change my mind. And then not more than, and more than just merely not harm others, I'll even try to actually benefit them. So we're developing, we're sowing the new seeds for the new gardens. Because Buddha says our mind comes from the past and it will continue inexorably into the future. Mind is beginningless and endless, the Buddha's view says, you know. It'll never end, so we better take care of our future gardens. So within this context then, that's how you live your daily life. Using karma as your basis for interpreting your experiences, which will already change you hugely, slowly, slowly. And then changing the way you behave, stop sowing the rubbish seeds, but also, crucially, purifying, as they call it, the rubbish parts, so that the seeds we have planted in the past won't ripen as more suffering in the future. So this purification practice, it's four main steps, and you will see, really, it's just psychological. So the first one is called, like, the four R's, you can call it, you know. The first one is regret. So regret is regretting something I have done in the past that will ripen as my suffering, such as killing, bad-mouthing. So we regret the harm we've done to other sentient beings. Because the logic is, if people are harming me now, I've got a karmic history with them, then that's due to my having harmed them in the past. So I know I don't want more suffering. I know I don't like being harmed. So it's easy to say I regret doing whatever I did in the past because I know I don't want suffering. So the first step for regret then is for your own sake. Not out of guilt and not out of compassion yet. It's for your own sake. If the suffering I'm having now is the fruit of my past actions, then it's like if you've got a bellyache because you ate the wrong food, of course you're going to regret having done it because you say, I'm an idiot having done that because, look, I don't want this suffering. That's reasonable. Or if you discover that by smoking cigarettes, you're going to get cancer. You're going to really regret having smoked cigarettes. What an idiot. I can't believe I've smoked cigarettes because I don't want the suffering of cancer. It's not guilt. Nothing to do with guilt. It's your own self-preservation. It's like compassion for yourself. So the first step is to regret the harm we've done to others in the past, which is how come they're harming me now. And I know I don't want that in the future, so that I certainly will regret it because I don't want the suffering. It's very tasty. And this is what accountability is too. You regret the harming, the killing, the lying, the bad-mouthing, the stealing, the rejecting others, the cheating on others, which causes the pain and hurt in our relationships now. Because I don't want the future suffering, and that's a fact. Then I think, well, whom can I turn to? Where's my doctor? So here's where we talk about taking refuge. If you're a Buddhist, you rely upon the Buddha. He's not your creator. He's like more like your mentor. He's more like your doctor who has methods that are my medicine that I choose to take to help purify myself, you know. So this is where the difference would be if, let's say, you're a Christian, and I was a Christian, a Catholic. But because I see God as my creator, and then a sin is defined as doing what God said you shouldn't do, therefore I must just ask God to forgive me. That's what purification is in Christianity. But Buddha is not your creator. It's got nothing to do with him. You are the creator of your own reality. So forgiveness is not the issue in Buddhism. He will forgive you. He's a nice person. I bet you will forgive you, but that's not what changes you. It's owning responsibility, regretting the harm I've done in the past with my body and speech to harm sentient beings, as well as regretting my own rubbish, the attachment and the anger and the hurt that propels that, because I don't want the future suffering. Then I think, well, whom can I turn to? I rely upon the Buddha. You take refuge, whatever, blah, you know. You rely upon this doctor whom you've chosen to use because you don't want the suffering, and you've checked that he's a valid doctor. That's up to us. Then the other one is, now the second step, you have compassion now for those who harmed us. You have compassion. Sorry, the first one is for those whom we have harmed. We have harmed. For those we have harmed, we have compassion. So you and your daughter, for example, Louise, if you've got the view of karma, she's harming you now, if you like. So then but you know that logically, because of the past harming, you've now got this karma with her, you know, this intense experience. So you can really have compassion for this reason. And then you have even more compassion for her because you realize she's harming herself. That's the basis of real compassion, actually. This is why the first step of regret is like compassion for yourself. You're sick of suffering. You don't want more suffering. And Buddha says all your suffering is coming from your own past actions. So then own it. Realize you planted those weeds. I'm sick of these weeds. I'm sick of this pain and hurt and suffering. So it's like real compassion for yourself. It is not guilt, not even slightly, because guilt is just self-hate and it's useless. It's ownership, you know, and it's like you're almost like you're crying because you're sick of your own suffering. You're fed up with this and I don't want it in the future. That's a fact. So you have real regret because you're sick of you regret for the causes that you put in the ground in your mind that will ripen as your future suffering, and I'm sick of it. Then whom can I turn to? You rely upon the Buddha. Then you have compassion for those you've harmed, and if you can, compassion. If Tracy can, have compassion for this person because they are, by harming her, by not taking care or whatever, and they're harming themselves. If you really can have that compassion, because you can see it with your daughter. She might make you crazy, but hey, baby, she's really making herself crazy. That's a fact, isn't it? So then that's the basis of compassion, that people harm themselves, you know. People harm themselves. The harmers, the terrorists, the rapists, the murderers, the pedophiles, the ugly ones. They're harming others because they're the victims now who were the oppressors. This is the tragedy. And now they will suffer in the future. So we've got to think this through carefully. And we can't have real compassion for others until we've got real compassion for ourselves, which means we've set ourselves up for our ridiculous nonsense. Then the third step is you do you practice a purification. We do certain visualization and mantras, whatever, you know. And the fourth one's the most important. This is where you make decisions to change. Given that the first one is you regret having done the rubbish that causes you suffering, and you know you don't want more suffering, then for sure, when you realize, let's say, I don't want to get cancer, then guaranteed the fourth step will be, I will never smoke another cigarette. This is where you make determination to change, the resolve to change. So you make decision, the basic level of morality. I will not kill, I will not steal, I will not this. And the main ones, you know, are the speech. We humans do so much rubbish with our speech, which causes so much suffering. So we vow never to kill, never this, never. We do our best to say these things. So that's where you make changes. So that's where you stop sowing the negative seeds. You regret the seeds you've already planted because you don't want the future suffering. You have compassion and take refuge. You do the practice of purify, and then you make a decision, I won't do those things again. And this is how you change your mind every day, you know. You change your mind this way. So what you're experiencing is a fruit of your past actions, by doing this action, this process, which is just psychological, you're changing the dynamics of what will happen in the future. We're in charge of our lives, basically, you know. It's a very powerful practice. Normally when I come here, I do these notes, which I didn't do this time, so I think I'm going to have to... Where's Sarah? Is she here? No. I'll print them out. We'll do these notes of different teachings, and I've got this particular teaching on purification. Okay. Well, then I'll do these notes. I've really forgotten. Maybe Robbie said I could print them. There's going to be quite a few, but maybe we print some and people or have them as a PDF either way. But it's nice to get something printed. People like their printed things? Okay. I think we should do a bunch of notes and they'll be available here for anyone who comes in the next week. You know, and I'll have teachings in there about karma, going into more details about the four ways karma ripens. We'll go into more teachings on dependent arising and emptiness, more teachings on compassion, on all these things I'm talking about, and on the mind. And then it'll be like 60, 70 pages. People can take one of those documents. But this practice is in there, you know. And maybe we can do it together at some... Are we doing karma at some point?
Yeah, tomorrow.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, tomorrow we'll go into it in more detail. Okay. So, any questions from all that? It's only 8:30. Seems like I'm going so slow these days. I can't believe it. Any questions from all that? Did all that make sense? It was a bit quick, but did it make sense, people? Louise, what do you think? Food for thought, baby? Good. There you go. Wendy. Yes, Wendy. What do you think, Tracy? An interesting view? Oh, I know. It's kind of intense. And I talk so fast, I too. It's true also. What, honey? What? You what? Okay. Well done, girl. Go on.
I wanted to respond to Scott.
What do you mean, respond to Scott? You want to give him a lecture? That's my job, not yours. No. I don't want you to tell something to... I don't want you to do that. Ask me a question. I will tell him what to say. Think, not you. You can give it. You can ask me a question if you like. I'm being very rude here, but I want to stick to this point.
I wanted to tell you something.
Oh, good. Tell me something. That's different.
Salinas the Dalai Lama was in Atlanta last year.
Yeah, tell me.
And someone in the audience stood up and asked him a question.
Yeah.
They said, I work for the Atlanta police on
yes.
the SWAT team.
Yes, that's wonderful to know.
And,
okay, tell, this is great for Scott to hear. Go on.
Sometimes we have to be very violent and we kill people.
That's right.
And I'm wondering how you respond to
okay,
that.
Yeah. What does Holiness say?
It doesn't seem compassionate to me.
Yes.
And His Holiness said, in your mind you have compassion
yes.
for that person.
There you go.
They're obviously
suffering.
In a terrible situation.
That's right.
And they're caught
there.
There
you
they
go.
Can't get out.
That's
but
right.
you, in your position, have to protect the innocent people.
There you go.
And if you have to take a wrathful action
right.
to do that.
Out of compassion.
Don't hesitate.
There you go.
You have to do that.
Look, but the key, isn't this is the point,
so
Wendy, that His Holiness is...
He upheld the responsibility of the man and encouraged him
yeah.
to be able to do his action without having conflict
yeah, that's right.
in his heart.
And so the key, isn't it, is compassion, isn't it? The key is the one, this is the thing. Okay, the best one would be not to do any of these things. The best one would be not to have to ever kill anybody. Of course it's the best. It's to play safe for our own sake. Because to really, as Wendy's point, you know, have you finished?
So I think he was trying to encourage him to be able to take wrathful action with a compassionate heart and not feel dichotomized about it.
Right, I understand. That's it. That's true, Wendy. Thank you.
Also, we have the precious general in the mandala offering, the precious mandala.
Oh, that's right. Yes, that's right.
The king in the kingdom.
No.
So
I understand.
There is a place for that position.
I understand. See, the thing is, if you look at the Bodhisattva, this is where it's in the Bodhisattva teachings, you know, the more advanced level of the teachings. In the first stages of teachings, which is what the playing safe one, back off, don't kill, don't lie, don't steal, don't do bad things, play safe, don't harm others. It's a really powerful basic teaching, you know. Then the more advanced levels in the compassion wing, where you really, we have to assume a person who's really got disciplined behavior, really understands their own mind, has developed renunciation, stopped harming others, and they know their minds deeply and well, then that person can go onto the Bodhisattva path. And there, you even, when you take Bodhisattva vows, you actually have a vow that you would do something harmful if it were truly for the sake of the other person. Like with your daughter. If she were really out of her brain and doing something, it would be good to lie to her. You must lie to her. Or you must steal her money if she's going to use it for drugs. That's a negative action, stealing or lying. But truly with compassion, you would do that. And you must do that to protect another person. And that's Wendy's point. So that's a tough one because we are living in an insane asylum. There is so much violence. And indeed, people who are police or in the services are maybe crazy guys who love killing people. I mean, that's another discussion. So it is a crazy world, you know. So if you're going to do something like that, it's dangerous, but to truly have the wish to do it with a pure motivation, to truly not want to harm sentient beings, it's a dangerous thing to do for your own sake, not for the other, for your own sake. You see my point. But it can. But then this is where the purification practice, because you're not doing it anymore, so it's very powerful. Any imprints you did put in your mind due to past karma, you chose that job. Do you understand my point? You ran to that job. Then you do the purification practice very strongly. And you do especially the one I will vow never to kill another sentient being. And then you'll wake up next life with no thought to kill anybody, even a flea. You understand? That's where it's very powerful. And that, of course, is, and you notice that too in Dharamsala with His Holiness. He has these people who protect him. Also, when he travels around, he's got the security, all the different cities provide security details for him, you know. And he's always so kind. I remember one time in Italy, when actually Lama Yeshe made us, there were 10 of us, he made us the security guards for His Holiness. It was 1982, and I was a nun at the time, but he made us wear lay clothes. I had hair, you know. And we all wore nice lay clothes, and I put lipstick on, and Lummi, yes, she used to laugh and say, oh, I think I like you better like that, you know. Anyway, we were the security guard for His Holiness for 2 months, traveling around with him. I mean, it was a joke, really, but how kind. He was so kind to us. We'd travel on the plane with him. We'd guard him at the teachings. We'd guard him in his hotel door. But I remember at one place, this Italian in Pisa, the local city sent this terror squad coppers. You know, they're like 20 young kids, young guys, young men. 25 or something, with a machine gun, looking so arrogant, you know. But by the end of the 10 days, they were just in the palm of the hand of the Dalai Lama. They just adored him like he was their daddy, you know. And he was so kind to these blokes, these cops, you know. It was very interesting to see that. And then his own guards in Dharamsala, he has these Indian police with their guns. He's always so kind to them. Because they are, there is this idea of protection. Protecting somebody. But it has to be coming from compassion, not out of rage. Often what happens is if Louise protects her son, let's say, and she'll then be angry at the person who harms them. But that's not cool. That's where killing somebody out of anger is what harms you. The anger is what harms you, you know. So it's really important our motivation is pure. So important. That's so important. Anyway, purification is a very helpful practice. And that's where also, at the end of the day, when we do this every day, as Lama Zopa says, we're insane not to do this every day. Because what purification is actually changing the dynamic of your own mind, changing your views, changing your attitudes, purifying your past actions, and training yourself to go in a new direction by deciding. Because it's your mind. Each of these steps is psychological. It's not religious, you know. It's psychological. You're changing your mind, which is the point of purification. It's not a cosmic kind of idea, you know. It's very, very powerful. And it gives you courage. Gives you confidence. Because you know you can, as Lama Zopa puts, you know you can mold your mind into any shape you like. Yeah. So what else? At 8:40, I keep finishing sooner, but it feels like we're finished again. I'm sorry. Yes, sweetie.
Hi, Venerable Rubina. Buddha had many... Buddha became enlightened, and he had a lot of experiences and thought a lot, and he said, karma is a natural law.
Okay, that's what they say, yeah.
That's what
Buddha says, yeah.
Karma is very helpful when I think about it.
Mm.
It's a good thought process in my life.
Yeah.
As we practice and become more skillful,
yes.
Would a practitioner understand more about why it's natural?
Of course, that's what comes from teachings. Listen, the first thing is, here we are taking on board Buddha's teachings as those of us who choose, you know? So to be able to hear the law of karma, it clearly is not something that's evident to our eyes, is it? It's something quite abstract. It's past lives, for God's sake. I mean, who even thinks past lives? So straight away, we think of that. We think it's religion, therefore it's a belief system. But Buddha, it's not a belief system. The Christian one is a belief system. God is the boss, and he doesn't want you to stick your nose into his business because he is the boss, and you better have faith in him. I'm not being rude. It's an amazing view. But here, it's quite different. Because think this one. If Buddha was a regular guy like you and me, a regular person, sick as a post, deluded, cheating on his wife. You get my point now? Ordinary person. So he then did this procedure, went into his mind, did all this stuff, did all this purification, did all this practice, and came up with his own direct experiential findings. He did not make it up. He didn't create it. He's not speculating. If he is, he's an outrageous fraud, and you should not listen to a single word and demand to get every penny back when you give him to this wretched center. I'm really serious. So we've got to take it on board that if he was a regular guy who turned into a holy being, that deduces that he has seen karma. He has seen every one of these things. So if he can do it, I can do it.
So there's some...
Are you seeing my point?
Yes.
So then the logical conclusion is, if you follow the same steps as him, you'll end up seeing what he saw, which is past and future, karma, realizations, clairvoyance, emptiness, and the rest. Can't you see my point?
I do.
Well, then.
So there's some faith involved in putting one foot in front of the other, seeing results, moving on.
Okay. The faith or confidence is based on you listening and thinking about it, and the first step has to be intellectual. Listen, if you'd only ever been involved in allopathic medicine, the regular stuff we have in our culture, yeah? And then one day you hear about these weird, wacky Chinese people who stick needles in people. Well, first of all, it's a shock, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can't believe these weird people. So you hear my point here.
I
so
do.
The first step has to be, if you keep hearing about people that they say about acupuncture, well, that's interesting. The first step has to be, I might look into this. You've got to have a mind to open up to the possibility that there might be something valid in acupuncture. That's mm-hmm. the first step, is it not? At the
yeah.
moment, you haven't got a clue. But so what's the first thing you're going to do that? What would you do in order to discover whether acupuncture is a valid system? What would you do? First step, logical. What would you do?
Observe and try.
And no, you wouldn't. You'd study it.
Well, study, yeah.
Well, that's the point. You'd listen to the theories. You'd have to listen to the theories. Would you agree with that?
Mm-hmm.
And would you agree with this? If the more you listen to those theories, if acupuncture is a valid system with coherent and intelligent and consistent and provable, if it is that, do you hear what I'm saying here? The more you learn the theories, the more it, all the pieces will fall into place and it will be coherent. Would you agree with that?
I do.
So keep, now wait a minute, wait. Do you accept that? And the more you study it, the more that piece will come into place, and then you'll hear that piece, which is consistent with this, and that'll fit with that piece. If it's a valid system, are you getting me? And that,
yeah.
whether it's medicine, music, cooking, or a worldview about the universe called Buddhism, it's the same logic. So the first step must be intellectual. You can't leap into experience first. You can't leap into making a perfect cake before the recipe. You can't leap into playing Mozart before you learn the notes. You can't suddenly know that karma is true before you develop your mind and lessen your delusions and develop clairvoyance and have single point of concentration so you can then see that it's true. That's way down the road. But what have you got to access to? The theories. And if Buddhism is a valid system, which you have to find out, it must be coherent intellectually. This is my point. Forget experience. It'll come ages later.
Yes.
Be content with intellectual coherence, intellectual
yes.
clarity, and then you'll have confidence based on that, on wisdom, on what you know so far. So, of course, there's confidence and faith there. Look at the word confidence, the Latin, with faith. Confide, but based on your noggin, based on what you know, based on intelligence, based on taking it as your working hypothesis. What else can you do?
That's helpful.
Good.
Thank you.
That's the point. One step at a time. And if, as the Dalai Lama says, you keep checking and keep learning and keep practicing, and you actually do what he says, like you follow the recipe, but you don't get the cake he said, and you really have done the right recipe, then he is wrong and you must reject him. Most of us don't go to this level of intense clarity and intellectual certainty. We're just happy. We like Buddhism, basically, and we enjoy being a Buddhist. We like it. Because of some past history. And we think it's coherent. But if we had to have a real debate, we'd be pathetic. Do you understand my point? So, you know, we only really do have faith, mostly. But to really know it's like this, to have the rigor, and that's why His Holiness says all the time, we must study the teachings. That's why I was saying to Sarah repeatedly, how about getting Geshe-la to teach more serious stuff here? But she never asks him. It's her job. So keep getting mad at her, please, and demand she keeps getting him to ask more things, to teach more things. All of you. You have to. What do you think? He's got this wretched Geshe form. He's not going to get him to teach stuff. He's got all his 40 years of education, or 30 or 20, whatever it is. He's not wretched. Excuse me, I like him. Get my point? Do you understand? You've got to learn the teachings. You can't just say, oh, I love acupuncture. I have faith in acupuncture. Oh, yeah, I have faith in it. Most of us only will have faith if you have a good doctor who does it for you. But we're talking about being an acupuncturist ourselves here. That's when you get the knowledge. I can rely on another Buddha to be kind to me, but if I want to help myself, I better become a Buddha myself. And that's the point. And then I can help others. You see my point? Are we communicating here?
Yeah.
It's only 10 to 9. Time to go home. Come on. Oh, yeah.
Yes,
sweetie.
So I killed.
Join the club. We all killed.
Not out of anger, but aborting a pregnancy.
Okay,
so can you speak about the karmic seeds I planted earlier and
Same.
Those that I'm attached to and why I was comfortable with killing?
Sorry, what? Attached to what? Sorry.
Could you just explain the karmic seeds in previous lives that made me comfortable to kill
okay.
for my own
selfish... Of course, it's perfect. It's fine. I mean, it's not fine. Whatever. It's just the same. Same with me when I was 23. So there I was in London. I was a hippie. You know, I didn't want a baby. I never wanted a baby. And I didn't even think of it as a person. I really didn't. I just knew I didn't want this wretched thing in my belly. So, you know, I went off and had an abortion. Of course I did. That's what we do. So what that means is this. There's a sentient being there who died a few weeks before its conception, who died from another body, with whom I have strong history. And they go into the intermediate state. This is really hilarious. They talk in great detail in the text. When you die, the subtle consciousness leaves the body, and then you go into this sort of weird, like a dream state. They call it the intermediate state. And because we've still got all this grasping for life, with this intense grasping at another basis for another me, basically, because you're all dead now, you know, and you're wanting another basis. And so that you're in the bardo, this is a sentient being, yours or mine, in the sentient being, and they're desperate for another basis for another I. And then in my case, I hopped into bed with this bloke, you know, I remember the bloke in London, this bloke, I was a hippie, so you sleep around, don't you? That's what I did, I was a serious hippie. So then I remember this fellow, and at this moment, it was very curious for me, I knew I got pregnant. That second I remember it. I never had that experience before or since. I knew. I didn't know the words for it then, but I thought, uh-oh, I'm pregnant, I said to myself, you know, drat. So what happened was, there's a sentient being in the bardo having just died, and then suddenly me and this person come together, and they run like a magnet to my womb. Got strong history together. In fact, I remember one lama saying, this really sounds hilarious. In the intermediate state, they say, when a male and female human are having sex, listen to this, billions of consciousnesses that have recently passed away, that's obviously more than humans because there aren't that many, who have recently passed away are all in their own intermediate state, frantic for another rebirth, billions of consciousnesses run to try to get into that womb. And we made it. We won. I can't believe this. Blows my mind, you know. So in the case of you and me, this little sentient being, due to past history, came to our womb. And then due to having harmed us in the past, we just had the thought, we're going to kill it. We didn't think kill it. I didn't think kill. I didn't think the word kill. I called it an abortion, you know. I didn't want a baby. So the imprint was there, the karma with this particular person. If it would have been another baby, maybe you wouldn't have had the thought to kill it. But there was karma, and this being must have been harmed by you in the past. In other words, it created the cause to be killed. Its being killed is one of the karmic results of having killed in the past. It got that karma. You know, and so the abortion took place. So we purify it by regretting, because we don't want the future suffering. Have compassion, do the practice, and vow never to do again. Answer?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, good. Okay, that's a pleasure. But, you know, I try to get a bit of balance here, and I think about a whale, a big whale who's hungry and opens its mouth for one mouthful of one breakfast. 40 million little baby fishies go in. One mouthful of one breakfast, and they last a long time. So we killed one baby. It's okay. He bombed a few people. Let's get some perspective. The poor whale, one mouthful of one breakfast, 40 million sentient beings it's killed. It's way ahead of us, babe. I'm not saying it's cruel to kill, but we all kill. And Buddha says we're living in this nightmare of samsara where we're all harming each other all the time, even without intention. You know? So it seems like if we're doing the weekend as karma, we've got to go more detail about this, about the purification, we'll do the practice, but also into more details about how we create karma, the details, the nuts and bolts of how we create karma, the factors that are at play, the role in the way we program ourselves. Because the basic idea of karma is we are the creators of our own reality, and that's every sentient being, Buddha says. Which is a really intense view, you know. And if it's true, we'd better know the nuts and bolts, so we can have a handle on it, you know, so we can be in control of the process. Which we'll talk about tomorrow. What time is it, Heath?
It's 10 to 3:30.
Okay, good. Is there a lunch break in there? 10 to 11, 12. It's only 4 hours. Or 5 hours. And people bring lunch?
Yeah, we
share. Good, good, good. Okay, that's great. Okay, well, good. So we'll carry on tomorrow. 4 o'clock is a natural link to tomorrow. To 10 o'clock. Okay, so we finished tonight. Food for thought. Much courage to Tracy, much courage to Scott, much courage to Louise, and to all of us, to keep on bopping, never giving up, having confidence in our own incredible potential, and our own capacity eventually to be of benefit to others on the basis of developing our own potential. Never giving up is the key to success. Never giving up is the one. Jamchob sem chogrin poche, ma kye pa nam ke gyo ching, kye pa nyam pa me pa yang, gong ne gong du ha wa shok. So may compassion grow and grow in the hearts of all. Because we're all in the same boat together, in this loony bin. So if I don't help, who will? Having this courage, you know.
Okay. And we've had an amazing show of generosity tonight with a number of sponsors.
Wonderful.
We'd like to thank Neil Oldham, whose dedication is for those suffering from depression, and to the Sangha for their guidance in helping us with this particular aspect of samsara. May we all find the path easier in this life and those to come. Sarah Cagle, whose dedication is, I dedicate whatever virtue I've created from listening to these teachings to the benefit of all sentient beings who have been my mother. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase more and more, and may these teachings shine forever. John Costello, may all beings everywhere with a mind weighed down by depression find relief and lasting happiness. We have an anonymous dedication in appreciation of Venerable Rabina's precious teachings. And Lynn Foreman, thank you to the many volunteers at Kadampa Center who show their dedication and love every day helping the Kadampa Center Sangha to thrive, and our sponsor, Paul Hagwood.
Okay, look.
And may I give your advertisement?
Oh, you go.
Yeah. So I'll do both. Yeah, we've got two. So for sale in the bookstore are DVDs called Chasing Buddha, which are a documentary that Venerable Rabina's nephew, Emil Korten, filmed. How long ago was it?
Years ago.
Yeah.
Kadampa Center, isn't
it? Yeah, the old Kadampa Center when we were in the other building. But it's been re-released with added features, including updates on the prisoners, and so you can learn a lot more about Venerable Rabina's prison work and her biography, her life. And she's leading a pilgrimage this fall, and there are postcards out on the tables in the lobby. I've been on it and can certainly share with you stories galore about what it's like to be on pilgrimage. Yes.
We're Buddha ladies' holy feet.
So all the major holy sites of Buddhism, and it's
we have
an
fun as well.
Yes, yeah, it's an incredible experience, life changing. Yes, it really is something that
you can bear that.
You'll never forget it. I promise.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.